Shall we begin?
Sure.
Okay. So this is a session on openness and on framing the net. I wrote my Publius piece about this, which will be up in 5 minutes, I was told, 4 minutes ago.
Publius? Not, what's that?
Yes, right.
What's that, Doc?
Publius was the name used by... Did you all hear about the Publius Project yesterday? Just so you know, some of you did. Publius is the name of the author, the name chosen by John Jay and Alexander Hamilton, the authors of the Federalist Papers.
I didn't mean to take you too far off track.
That's all right. I'm not on one to begin with, so my attention span is like a dirt road with sidetracks. So anyway, a little bit about framing. I'll try and do cognitive linguistics 101 in less than a minute. Everything that we talk about, including openness, we talk about in terms of something else. We're always talking about a second thing. We borrow the language of one subject and we talk about another. And it's entirely unconscious. So, for example, take time. What do we talk about time in terms of?
Hours, space.
Units, okay. So if we say we save time, we spend time, we put it aside, we invest it, what are we saying? We're saying time is money. It's almost impossible to talk about time without using the language of money. The same with life. What's the metaphor for life, the foundational metaphor for life, when we use more than anything else? It's interesting. It's a great demonstration of how unconscious this is. So if we say birth is arrival and death is departure and choices are crossroads and careers are paths, or we fall off the wagon and we get stuck in a rut, or move in the passing lane, or any of these other things, we're saying that life is a journey. We're saying life is travel. We borrow the language of travel when we talk about life. We actually can't help it. So what do we use when we talk about the net? If we say, for example, that we have content that we're moving through pipes and distribute to end users or consumers, we're saying that it's a transport system. And in fact, we actually build the net on transport protocols. If the net's suite of protocols is full of transport language. If we say that we build sites where they get visitors on the information highway, and we design them, and we build them, and we hire designers, we're saying that it's real estate. We borrow the language of real estate. We talk about the internet as a place. When we talk about cyberspace, it also has a locational quality to it. We borrow the language of space and place for that. Another one is if you say you have pages that you author and you put up and you syndicate, we're saying that the net is a publishing system. That's a third thing. That's the one that Tim Berners-Lee introduced when he came up with the idea behind the World Wide Web as a web of documents that are linked by hypertext. And with blogging especially, we expanded the whole notion of what we do on the net as a publishing thing. When Dave Weiner changed rich site summary to really simple syndication, he moved from the metaphorical framework of building to the metaphorical framework of publishing. And in fact, he purposefully said, I was hoping he'd be here, but he's not, but he purposely said at a certain point that he's in the publishing industry rather than the computer industry because he wanted to grow the publishing industry with blogging. That was a conscious decision on his part, and one of the reasons we blog the way we do is because he made that decision. The decisions we make about the frames that we choose, those are all frames, have effects. Net neutrality, for example, is a very hard thing to argue in Congress because the Communications Act of 1934 and with the Telecom Act of 1996 is not just thick with the language of transport, it is the language of transport, almost entirely. And it's very hard to get that framing out because in some of it is very neutral. For example, the container cargo industry is very neutral toward the contents that are carried, but it's not entirely neutral. Every container, for example, has a little STC on the corner, which is being said to contain. And if it's said to contain something toxic, for example, you might handle that somewhat differently. So that's, I just want to put the framing issue on the floor that way. And so okay, turn it over to the other two guys.
So to continue on that, I think the other piece that's important to think about is that these things are very, very actively and while in our language we often use these somewhat unconsciously, when the net is an entirely designed universe. And so right now this use of metaphor becomes something that moves a lot to the forefront of this type of design work. So just taking some of the things that Doc was talking about, if you look at your browser, you know, the way you can navigate, which is again that travel metaphor, is you can go forward and back. And so that shapes a lot of your experience in moving through this network. So notice I cannot even talk about this without the metaphor of moving, the metaphor of a network, but this is not a particularly network. A lot of these metaphors tend to be quite mixed. And how they're mixed and where they break down often really limits how we think about things. So for instance, if you were used to a browser that gave you much more of a path of the trees that you follow, your experience would be very different. How often you might have to go back to, say, a site such as Google or a Yahoo homepage would be very different. Your way of, there have been studies that have shown that people see particular node points. They don't remember particular things that they traveled through, again, to use the travel metaphor, on their way through the net. They sort of are always looking at particular anchor points that they return to. So a lot of the design of the interface really affects the types of experience that you have in your expectation. The notion of things like pages, a lot of these metaphors are based on things we're used to from very office-like environments, aside from the fact that we simply call big suites of software office. But when you think about, for instance, most of the things you do in terms of sorting through these documents are very physically based. So you can put them in folders. You have to put your email into a folder. And for many people, this is somewhat of a stymieing effect. Because once you have to decide, well, is this about my friends, or but this is a friend that I work with, does it go into work, but it was based on a particular project, the easiest thing is to give up. Because it's about putting things in a single place where that singularity wasn't necessary. It helped people understand it in a very easy way. More recently, we've come up with a somewhat simpler and actually much more robust notion of tags, which is again a different type of metaphor where you give things lots and lots of different labels, which gives you a tremendous level of freedom in terms of how you think about it. With the use of metaphor, things like folders were deliberately introduced, even though people were quite aware at the beginning how limiting they were, because it's very, very hard to move into abstract spaces. And I think this is a big revolution in thought that we're going through now, because as we live increasingly in a information space, and you can sit here and start counting all the metaphors that I use.
Yeah, I know, it's hard to ignore
it. It's just very, very hard to talk about these things without these very spatial metaphors. But we're working with things that are not inherently spatial. We are applying that spatialness to them. Which spatial metaphor we apply will greatly change the power of what we can do. But, on the other hand, the more abstract they are, often the more powerful they are. Tags is a much more abstract concept than folders, but it turned out that many new consumers find very abstract, unfamiliar pieces much harder to assimilate. And so it's often much easier to start with something that's very tangible, but very constrained. If you look at something like Second Life, it's very comfortable to a lot of people, but it's very, very constraining. You know, you can say, well, we have this university here. Many universities said, we'll build a Second Life campus. What they've done is they've replicated it. You can find a replica of this very room down to the lights, the windows, the little notions on the chairs. It gives you a great deal of familiarity, and it gives you a tremendous understanding of how to behave in that space. We did a study called Why Are There So Many Chairs in Second Life? And it turns out that what's interesting here is that to think about it is that these metaphors are not necessarily just words as metaphors, but they're images as metaphors. All kinds of things can have this metaphorical construct. And so a chair can function online as a metaphor because chairs around a table tell us that everyone here is somewhat a round table, everyone is equal. A head of the table gives one person special qualities. When David walked into this room, he said, this room is not conducive to conversation. Indeed, you know, here I am lecturing to you and you're all sitting here taking notes. Nobody has interrupted me. I'm sure some of you have disagreed with things. I'm sure some of you were burning with better examples than I had, but the layout of this room said to you, I am going to sit here and receive the wisdom being imparted from the front. And so we'll come back to this, but I think one of the things to think about is it's not simply the big underlying issues, but the as an increasing amount of commerce and day-to-day social interaction is carried out online, there's a lot of subtleties in the different designs that really affect different power situations, people's notions of what should be private. The whole notion of, for instance, privacy as a very metaphorical construct, and we build sort of metaphorical spaces. If you are in a traffic jam, you will realize that people feel that an enclosure gives them privacy, even though you can look in the window very easily. So if you look at people stopped at a stoplight, they're putting their makeup on, they're looking to see what's inside their nose. You know, there's all kinds of things you would only do in private, but you've set that sense of privacy. Not listening to people talking at a table around you at a restaurant is a designed acceptance of a private kind of capsule. And so when we start thinking about how we feel about things like profiles on Facebook becoming open to all different systems, a lot of our understanding of it has to do with the model of what's a private space and what is public. So I hand it over to you for further introduction, then hopefully we can have more discussion from everyone.
So first of all, I'm not sure you can see
Matt, George Lakoff,
who is the sort of the font of...
Yeah, can I say a couple words about George?
You asked me, did you want to?
Yeah.
You're asking me to.
Yeah, no, I'm asking if you'd mind if I did. George is a father of cognitive linguistics, and which was born when he was an apostate of Noam Chomsky's at MIT back in the 60s. And an interesting thing, just in respect to what you just said, is that one of his insights is that metaphor is not just language; it's actually embodied. What Judith was saying, that you know, when we're in a car, we actually are part of the car. We see the car as an extension of ourselves. Our experience as embodied creatures in the real world, in the physical world, is inevitably carries over to the online world. We don't really have the online world fully worked out yet. It's weird, right? So the sense of proximity, for example, that we have here, where we can talk to and see each other, it's different when you're on the phone, it's different when you're online. The sense of distance isn't quite there. The net eliminates distance. Yet we're used to that in the real world. So I feel like it's very early in this stuff when we're working this stuff out. Anyway, go ahead, David. Sorry.
No problem. So Jude put up the name of the crucial book, which is Lakoff and Johnson. I put up another one, which is by Lakoff only, Fire and Dangerous Things. Only in parentheses because it's not actually on this topic, it's actually on the topic that taxonomy and classification, which some of us have a particular interest in. So,
some of us have a book on that.
Well, and this was...
Never good.
Yeah, this was an important explication of Eleanor Roche's theory of...
The only book of his I have not read.
Nobody has. It's impenetrable. Nobody's
got. I was thinking if you read it, you should get a...
But it's in large
work or something. Yeah.
it's anyway, so I'm interested in, you know, fundamental framing is extraordinarily difficult to change, as I think the examples make clear. We can't get through the discussion without talking about space, for example. We can't talk about the web without talking
through
about space.
Through the discussion.
It is exactly. Through the discussion. These are not simple cognitive switches, and we say, okay, let's not think about the net as space anymore. Let's think about it as, you know, as an ecology. Okay, that's fine, but it's not going to work. We're talking poetry here. I mean, it takes something much more than discussion, rational analysis to change fundamental framing. So why would we even, you know, why? Why do we care about this topic? And I would suggest two reasons, both of which, you know, pretty much heard. One is that you can learn a lot about about the thing you're studying by watching the framing, and you can see where the framing breaks. So privacy, great example. We take over notions of privacy on the sidewalk, we move it onto the web, that onto the net, that works, you know, fairly well, but then you start thinking about all the disanalogies and you see that you may be making assumptions that you shouldn't have made this analogy is stronger than you thought. A very quick example of this is the spatial analogy that we use when moving, when we move through the internet. At some point, we might want to talk about the fundamental framing of the internet in terms of packets, also, by the way.
But yeah, which also it's still transport.
Yeah.
It's still mail, it's still moving stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It's more like mail than a truck in many ways.
Right.
That's, you know, they always take out the envelope, and that's the example, they hold up the envelope of contents. Anyway, so the space framing is pretty fundamental to our experience, not just our thinking of the web, but our experience of it. We feel like we are moving through the web, but then you can point out what everybody knows, but some, you know, sometimes useful to point out that even there's a fundamental disanalogy to space, that what makes the web spatial is the fact that there are links from A to B, but unlike in the real world, they don't have to be links from B to A. So if A is next to B on the web, in the real world, if A and B are next to each other, A is next to B, B is next to A on the web, nah, you're gonna have A next to B and B just not even know that A exists. So in fundamental disanalogy, it can help clarify our understanding, can help us from making some mistakes, too easily think. So that's one reason to think about frames. Another is that there are political implications to frames, which Doc alluded to quite early, and net neutrality, I think, is actually quite a good example here, where somebody, Tim Wu, who was here yesterday, maybe Don
said today, he said he was going to be back.
Yeah, great. A named person we know who did it came up with the phrase, net neutrality. Tim Wu came up with the phrase, and he did it for a political purpose. I mean, he wanted to influence the debate over those issues, which we can skip unless you want to talk about them. The way the framing that existed did not make clear to the it was framed technically. It was being framed technically to policy people who were listening to economic interests that were not framing it technically. They were framing it in a whole bunch of ways that made much more sense. So Tim came up with a reframing of it, which ties it to fundamental ideas about discrimination, about equality, important values in democracy. Now you may. This may be propaganda, it may be accurate, but that's not the point. It was an on-purpose reframing that has taken root to some degree. So it's doing it on a topic that by itself we don't have a lot of experience with as individuals. So reframing the internet away from place, since we experience it as place and we can't help but talking about it as place, I think that's way harder than reframing a political discourse about whether packets should, you know, treatment of packets at the router level. I mean, that's just so far removed from experience that it's more susceptible to the intentional reframing that Tim Wu and then Wu followers did. So that's the second reason why I think it's important to look at framing. There are political consequences that can be a tool for politics as well. So that implies, I think, in fact, just one more thing. That in the examples that we've seen, there have been two basic ways in which some form of framing or reframing has happened. One is the Tim Wu explicit think about it, do the PR exercise. Basically, it's a PR exercise. You know, how can we put this better to change some votes? Very hard to do successfully. There are lots of tries to reframe that neutrality before Tim came up with that. And the second is, Judith gave a great example of it, of tagging. That we have been in a folder frequently on computers, starting with PCs and then moved on to the net. We have this folder mentality, which is familiar to us, but very confining. I mean, folders, real world folders are great for paper and they're terrible for filing ideas electronically. Because real world, you put one thing in one folder, that's it. It's one label. It's put in one spot. I mean, it's just a stupid limitation digitally. So tags came along, and tags have been, you know, successful with that. And they've been pretty successful. They haven't swept the world, but lots of people use them without actually thinking or caring about them. So
they sometimes do they do aided search too now. So Google now respects tags.
So
it's become part of PageRank.
So yeah. Tagging is an interesting thing because it is it both takes a common tags are physical things. We know what tags are in the real world. They get attached to your toe when you die, that sort of thing. I mean, or you're wearing them. I hate to make this analogy. You're also wearing them on.
If I put this on my toe, will that be something?
Yeah. So some innovation came along. It provided a new affordance, something new that we could do. It was attractive and appealing. It had use, so it got taken up. And so this new framing got introduced inadvertently. In a sense, inadvertently, it's because people like they found tagging useful, and so now people are thinking about things differently. And on occasion, if you try to match up the two and you say every tag is a new bookshelf, every tag is a new folder, people will look at you, will take them a second to get the connection between the framings. You click on a tag and you are assembling a bookshelf that otherwise might have been assembled by a curator. The distance between the frames actually is, it's a real distance that can be overcome, but it's a real distance. So this the second way that this framing, reframing seems to get introduced is inadvertently because somebody uses it, they innovate some piece of technology. And now we find ourselves thinking about things differently. I'm done. I'm particularly interested, for political reasons, in the intentional reframing to achieve political aims, which I think, not sure, but I think can only be done sort of higher up the stack of frames. So.
I'd just like to add one thing about what Tim Wu did with net neutrality. One of the points that Lakoff makes in Metaphors We Live By, he sources somebody named Michael Reddy, who figured that in human experience there are many things that fit into the category called conduit. And that's all of transport, for example. An interesting thing is that what Tim did is reframe within the conduit area the debate around what you did with transport back into mail, which people understand very well, and which David Reed, for example, at the FCC hearing here, did a brilliant job of taking an envelope and showing how packets moved and how they're organized, and how what Comcast had to do was open somebody's mail, find out they were doing BitTorrent, close the mail, and kill it, and throw in the trash, and that how that was wrong, and people understood that totally. So, and that it really reframed within the contextual reference system that is the FCC, something that they understood very well. So, yeah.
So, what brings you to this session? Is that a reasonable question?
I'll start. One of the sort of questions that I've had for a long time is, you know, in software development, we talk about users, and I've always hated that sort of like, why are people who use drugs in software called users? We still have this question on the internet, right? How can we reframe the notion of participating online as something other than passively consuming media?
Up a lot when I burn it in the fire. That feels very differently than writing something to me. I feel like, personally speaking, I feel like a producer. There are times I feel like I watch my TV. I use salt if I'm cooking, say, or something in a recipe. I might use drugs. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, it's one of those words. That's a catch-all. It's like the word content.
Euphoria is
what's that?
Euphoria is in a computer experience.
Yeah, I remember how, you know, I was a writer for a long time, and then all of a sudden I was a content provider. You know, like my words got wrapped in on a skin and sold at Costco or something like that. And there's something about content that doesn't increase. It doesn't. There's nothing. It's just packing material, sort of. For the container business. John Craig Barlow once said, it was a brilliant line, he said that we didn't start hearing about content until the container business felt threatened. But now we all use that, right? So I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's a good question.
But just to take it a little bit deeper also and bring back some of the privacy issues, when you use something and you think of it as very passive, you don't expect, for instance, what you're touching to be traced. Now, if you've thought that, and when you think of reading as a process that doesn't leave much of a mark. On the other hand, if you use a different metaphor that said, you know, that you are, you know, there's a writer's name I will come up with in a minute, but who talked about producerly media as opposed to readerly or writerly media. If you feel like you are producing something when you are reading something, then the understanding that there might be a system that's tracking what you do and that you are leaving traces behind, if it's framed that you are contributing a implicit ranking to those things, it feels very different. You have a very different awareness of what the privacy boundaries are. Things like that. Again, it's similar with mail. You know, I think one of the things that we have to do, it's not necessarily that everything must be private, but one of the problems is when we have metaphors that imply a certain level of privacy and then it's not carried through is when things break. So our notion of mail is that mail comes in an envelope and it is read by its receiver. If you are running a corporation, you want to make sure that people know that, well, they might be sending messages in the corporation, they don't get outside of the corporation, but your boss is free to read them. One of the important things isn't to send a notice out once a year stating that, but to change the metaphors in terms of the words you use and what you do visually so that people have much more of a sense that, for instance, they might be writing directed messages on a public bulletin board, and then they'll be able to frame what they say in the appropriate metaphor and their own understanding of how they want to frame things there. I just wanted to bring up one additional one, unless you had something here.
I'm curious about whether you want to pursue alternative framings for users.
But within that, I just thought there was one that might be interesting to discuss here, and partly Lewis's presence reminded me of this. But I think an interesting one for us to think about is how many of you are involved in open source? The word open. Open source? So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting one in terms of how metaphors are used to frame it, because one of the questions is contributing to open source communities a gift? And gifts are a very complex and interesting metaphor, because if you give a gift, what are your expectations? It turns out the more you look at gifts, and Lewis probably has more to say about this than I do, but they're very, very delicate. That when you get a gift, you usually expect something in return. If you give someone a gift at Christmas and they don't give you one, it's embarrassing. But on the other hand, once they are considered to be equal exchanges, then you have an exchange relationship. And so the thing that separates gifts out from even exchanges is that the process of reciprocal gift giving increases a social bond. And I think that's where a lot of the interesting question about what are the bonding aspects and the social side of open source development, and does this work within a gift relationship? So.
So
And it's, so there's this building materials, if you get over this building metaphor again, of stuff laying around that you can make stuff out of. And you're not using it, you're building it. So that's fine.
Louis High?
I'd like to get drawn into the gift thing, but it's endless. So let me, in terms of what I'm currently doing, two things I'd like to see up here are the metaphor of the commons and then the corollary metaphor of enclosure. So, you know, Jamie Boyle famously announces for the period of the second enclosure as opposed to a commons of the mind. There's much to say about this, but like it on the table. Is this a useful way to talk about what's going on? Are there problems with it that in the spheres you mentioned? Is this a politically powerful way to speak, or is this...
Well, I don't hear about the second enclosure.
Yeah.
I hear, you know, at the Bergman Center, there people talk about commons frequently. I don't know how common, so to speak, that framing is. Let's just see if we can get a great butt. Anybody? The commons a framing that you encounter, that you care about, that seems to work?
Absolutely, of course. So for example, JC's 2x2 matrix, the other day moving from the libertarian to the communitarian sphere, we might consider that an open access regime turning into a managed CPR without a hierarchy in place. What he's talking about there mirrors what Eleanor Ostrom and others are talking about, the management of rivalrous resources, common gold reserve.
So you didn't actually use the word commons.
There's a lot of depth to this frame, because as we see in the description of how things happen in this non-rivalrous space, in the cyberspace, evolve, it more and more mirrors what, in some cases, what's happening in the natural physical space.
I think that. Is not limited in that sense, but there are many things about information, such as attention, that may be. So I think a big piece to think about as you're coming into this discussion is, what is the limited aspect in the information world that fits into the language of commons? Yes?
Yeah, part of the problem with a word like commons is it has too many meanings to be useful in conversations, you have to qualify. And we also have the tragedy of commons, which is giving people sort of a bad model.
The bit commons?
Which basically means bits.
The sea of bits, is that?
Well, the sea of bits, yes. Basically, the idea is information is a very complex concept. We have something simple like rangeland or bit. there are two kinds of internet. One is where you just have, you don't measure it. The other is where it's internet relative to what you're trying to accomplish. So if you have, a finite number of, cows on a very large rangeland, it's effectively infinite. It doesn't mean there are no kinds of limits, but relative to the needs, it's infinite. But those are very simple topics. When you start to get more complex information topics, you start to find new limits that you can gain to gain advantage. So even if you have open source of things, you start to get into gaming, which is a different kind of thing than sort of, rivals necessarily. You find new ways to gain advantage. But I think a very simple concept, big comics, is that, it's one extreme.
I just wanted to see if I somewhat answered to this question, what is the limited aspect of the information world that sort of gives us the commons? I'm just thinking about our commons in Boston. It's a place where we are under social pressure not to leave trash behind us. It's a place where dogs are allowed off-leash only at certain times because other people are afraid the dogs will pat their children or something. There are social norms that are required to be there and that are enforced occasionally by rangers. And I think that a commons online is, and perhaps in my opinion ought to be, limited by some norms of behavior that makes it a safe place. We all know what's going to happen here. It's not our space.
So this is one of the, I want to point out, this is actually a really good example, I think, of the power of framing. It actually goes back exactly to the thing that Doc said that I sort of tried to steer him away from, so I'm very glad he said it. So Commons and Boston Common, get a vivid picture of it. It's some bounded space. It comes with a set of norms. There are all sorts of things you cannot do, and if you violate those norms, the place becomes not useful because there are, who knows why. So, it would not be useful commons anymore. But, so the commons framing, though, it captures a lot, but what it misses is Doc's third point, the thing that is not in nature, which is anybody can improve it. Because you are not allowed to go into Boston Common and dig it up and say, well, I'm losing. No, this is going to be great. You're just not allowed to do it or plant your own tree. So the commons get to the notion of shared resource, but it masks the notion that this is something that we don't just use, but we build. That we
and also masks the tracking aspect, the privacy aspect of that.
Not to mention
part of the bottom. Very public. It's very public. What you do matters. You can't reveal the private parts in plain subject. But what is it supposed to
do?
I think the point that you just asked was there are limits, or what are the limits? And I'm suggesting that perhaps Doc's point may not always be socially acceptable. Everybody can improve it or slash change it.
The reason I wanted to bring this up was that with code, the limits of practicality. Okay, so it's, if there's a saying that programmers have in all these communities, which is show me the code. If you don't know the code, you're not in it. It doesn't matter whether you're my uncle or my friend or my wife or husband. If you don't know the code, it doesn't count. That's different than the kind of anyone can improve it you might get in a commons where you have a sea of bits, it's essentially infinite, and if you find an idea that helps improve that or helps us understand that, or Tim Wu coming up with a new concept that improves on our understanding of the conduit metaphor or the transport metaphor and reframes things, that's an improvement, right? And I suppose that has a practical aspect to it as well. He's not doing it just for that reason, he's doing it maybe for political reasons, maybe for others.
Framing is all about our reptile brain. The reptile brain is what points attention. As we know, philosophy is all about your starting points and attention. All right. Framing, the reptile brain attends to danger before it attends to opportunity. This is well known. Right? The Tragedy of the Commons was a successful book for whoever it was. It's a framing that we've all accepted because it was as a threat. The fact is, usually we have a triumph. But because we've got this phrase, this beam in our head, we think this is what rules. It doesn't. A church is a commons. The club is a commons. Harvard University is a commons. Facebook is a commons. Now, Facebook, they all successful, I think we need to have the presence of mind to realize that most of the things we've done are successful, not a danger, but our reptile brain tells us that dangers are more important, which is what the cable news is about.
I just wanted to sort of get back to one of Jenny's points that I think is an interesting one with this question of sort of information trying to act like physical things. What anchors our identity in ourselves in the physical world is your body, which is sort of finite in its extent. And we don't really deal with history very well in the physical world. You know, what you say in sort of the pre-everything's recorded era sort of moves into this ephemerality of the past very, very quickly. And so that's where a lot of our thought comes from, is something where space is everything and time is very, very hard to grasp. But one of the things is that information, with its easy archival side, a lot of what really anchors our identity online has no spatial aspect, but it has this growing temporal side. And so again, one of the ways this comes up with this notion of commons is that things have existence online to a large extent in a accumulative form. And so while your job on the Boston Commons, in terms of improving it, might be to go there and look nice, but not really to leave a trace of yourself, in a lot of our online spaces, they are, where this metaphor does break, is a lot of what you do is about leaving some kind of trace. The person who comes and leaves no trace at all, we call things like lurkers. They're, you know, they are not a contributor in any sense. So that might be the other word for users. I mean, they're our audience, and we like them, but we really like our audience to leave some trace, some sign, some, like, at least a little verifiable notion of their presence. And so I think that's one of the places we need to think about how we use this metaphor, because everything we're doing in these spaces really is about transformation, even if it's just our navigation through them.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I think everyone can think of some ways that Facebook and Parler are not commons. It seems, just listening to people talk about commons, it seems like commons is a pretty loose notion that a bunch of people have agreed on as kind of an antipode to property, private enterprise, markets, control way of thinking. It sounds like there might be maybe like sort of three distinctions between, just to sum up with for what everyone said so far, in terms of different kinds of commons. It sounds like there's a question of scarcity between infinite resources and the range and tight resources where you could have a tragedy in the commons. There's a question of ruin, and that do users have the authority or the power, or that can users ruin it? And is there anything stopping them from ruining it? And is it, like, in theory, ruinable? And then there's a question of authority. If things get out of line, does anyone have, like, a special, you know, button to, like, as Facebook and Harvard do, so to lock the thing up and to, like, you know, erase the commons frame and put it back under control?
Over here, and then Bob's head is hand up also.
You tossed out another frame that seems to capture some of the ones that we've talked about: producers, users, lurkers. This concept of identity, which is being shaped at the internet, I think, workshops and other places. Can we capture in those protocols for online identity the notion that identity is not necessarily so individualistic, but also communally created?
I think the answer is yes. Bob had his hand up.
I think it's a great point and a really important frame. I think that some of the different, differences between within the community about the nature of identity actually go back to that very question of how identity is being framed.
There's an ultimate side of that, which is status.
Are you on the same topic?
Yes, I am.
Then, Bob, can we come back in a moment? Because you always have good things to contribute, so.
I like your comment very much because I think particularly in the West, we view identity as being something that is hardwired into the individual, and it's the wrong unit of analysis. In fact, in psychology, they talk chances of behaving like your peer group are much higher. So when we look at the unit of analysis, I would like us to also look at sort of group level behavior, you know, the social psychology of interaction in these commons, et cetera. I think that it's a much more appropriate way to look at it than to look at the individual.
Okay, I mean, seeing George Lakoff's name on the board takes me back nearly 40 years. I did a real thing started language wars at MIT, and there were issues, you know, the words I'm thinking of now are things like topology and ambiguity and different measures. For example, identity is a very complex concept, and one problem is, again, like commons, we tend to pin it down to various meanings, like single login, which becomes trivial. And I think in terms of the commons and rivals, non-rivalists, the reason I bring the word topology is there are different measures. If you think of stakeholders, that, you know, a commons works if you get some benefit, but you'll become a stakeholder in a different way. But you might, again, you might then game it up on some measures. So I think we have to be very careful about, you know, talking sort of a very general level with this. And, you know, again, we're in law school, and I think one thing, you know, like law school is, you don't argue moot cases and establish law, because specifics matter a lot. And, you know, I think we need more, you know, look at very specific examples how things like, you know, open source plays out. As Doc pointed out, open source, it needs a dictator in many ways, because you don't have another measure of, you know, what wins and what doesn't.
But it's actually run by dictators. Every open source code base has a dictator.
Yes. And so, and it's like, I
mean, the committee of dictators, but they're
dictators. David Reed's point yesterday is science has become another, you know, in academia has become another business model. You need to deliver a product. So we need to be very careful, I think, about assuming that, you know, that there's just this, you know, general comments or things. And you need sort of the pragmatic, you know, how are we using identity for this purpose? You need a context.
Over here, it's something.
Philip, I promise.
Okay. I don't want you to get lost.
Much to all three of those. The other side of this is the use. And while we talk about identity, but the words, the metaphors were about sort of production to user, and not user and status. And you all touched on a little bit. So I, as a user, participate, go to the comments, do things. Due to norms, because I get a certain status, and to the point of Facebook, you know, I participate in Facebook and I get status. I get people to post on my wall, I get things to show up in my newsfeed. People take action for my status. So status is very important, especially as we get closer to Generation Y. There's a huge amount of status in what people perceive of me. Much
status
more.
Status is situational also.
Very much.
Certainly a lot of work on status has been very linear. Bourdieu's work on status is a very linear notion. And I think a lot of the more recent sociological analyses, as well as perhaps, you know, a lot of people's sort of practical way, is realizing that people live in multiple status hierarchies. And so that while status is very important, when you see it framed as a society where there's a top, a medium, and a bottom, it's much too simplified. But then we are recreating that type of monolithic society in these interfaces and things like Facebook or MySpace's top 8. But And then there's a part of that, part of that's making the design simple, and then part of it gets back to a lot of the vagaries of how we physically deal with our computers. Because, for instance, while we are in a very text-based world, it is just hard to deal with a list of people in something other than a linear space. And so that can be part of the importance of thinking about the next generation of interfaces that one of the things I'm personally very interested in is arguing that we need often a much more graphical world, because the textual world implies some very, very, but I haven't finished before you shake your head, no, but the problem is that graphical does not necessarily have to mean literal graphics of the style of Second Life. You can use graphics to be even more abstract than the linearity that you get in texts like this, and I think these questions of status very much get at those issues. But it's important to understand how much you think of this as something that branches. And it ties back into your question of the framing of identity, where we have a single word, identity, to mean two very, very different things. The notion of individual identity, who am I separate from all other people, versus who am I as a type. You know, like I'm female, I'm a certain age, I'm in academia, that can be completely separated from individual identity. And a lot of our privacy issues come down to how much do we want to separate these things out that we now fold into this one notion of identity. So you were shaking your head vigorously, and then there's someone in the back who...
How many people here are mathematicians? We use the word identity is just a measure. And I think it's not just individual, but this is the trap we fall into, because identity think of people, where's actually coming from. But mathematically, it's just an arbitrary measure against a purpose. So, like an identifier doesn't necessarily mean it's a thing, it's just a handle you use. And this is, the concern I have, like text versus graphics. Tell that to a poet. A word could be worth 1,000 pictures. Again, operationally, I'm not sure what it means. People will discuss the term order catalysis. You take an undifferentiated field and you suddenly start changing it itself. And I think what we're doing is, we're learning how to live in these new ecologies. Like, for example, there's a big risk to say no. You learn to spell no, yes, but just not mean it. That's the thing the Japanese use.
So,
Dean was in the
back. I would just like to add.
It's working.
I just want to add, for the sake of the outline there, that in terms of identity, there's three issues to be considered. There's asserted or self-asserted identity. There's designated identity as designated by others, which of course is not necessarily a good thing, but not always a bad thing. And then there's presumed identity. And presumed is a loose way of saying all people who answered "ad for Chevy Malibu" or something, and we get into logical syllogisms about that, but there are presumptions which are not necessarily correct. But it's really important in terms of identity, because that gets back to the individual being able to assert for themselves, and I think that's an important point in talking about this.
Right. So I want to go up the stack a measure. We're down in sort of working out what ID means. We have competing theories and ways of pulling apart the topic. Are we having a discussion about framing that? Is this discussion about how ID should be decomposed, so to speak, and understood and analyzed? Is this a framing discussion? And if not, what would you make it into?
What's the framing?
Well, let's hold off.
You missed that part, Bob, too late.
Are we having a framing discussion?
I don't have
that much time left. I don't want to have to spend it having an interesting discussion about ID. I want to talk about framing. So at the very least, I want to, you think this is not a framing discussion?
I think it is framing.
Well, I know, Jenny, you were nodding, but the woman next to you is saying no.
It didn't seem like you were talking about identity as how we identify ourselves on the internet, frames what the internet is. I guess that's what you're trying to get at.
Okay.
framework of the internet as an unsafe place.
David,
I'm sorry, don't forget anything.
Just a quick comment. Well, one frame that we've been using all along is that we're somehow in control of what's happening. We're trying to figure out rules and set up the side and so forth. Another framing of this is it's an emergent, characteristics of emergent system things that we created this again, but it's sort of take off life and stuff. And we have to say that we're in control of all of this. I think a lot of things we're struggling with are emergent properties of this system that we don't control in ways. And I think framing it as how do we set about controlling and fixing and improving this thing may itself be a kind of alliance that we have.
So this is the framing of framing.
But not quite in the public, and the glow of the
We have 3 more minutes.
3 minutes.
Bring it on home. I see it. I want to continue getting people to have this hope. That's okay. That seems fair to me.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's kind of important that we have to realize in the room right now, we're framing our discussion by framing it in terms of, I think, you guys, and by you guys, I mean the adults. Because when I think of how, of my relationship to the internet, it's not as a user, space that is violent or scary, it's more a playground or even at home. I'm sure that in the last academic year, I probably spent more time online than sleeping in my bed. It can be, because I learned so much just by spending time on the internet, and I sacrificed for sleep, sure. But it's just the approach from someone who has been introduced to computers versus who grew up with computers is very different. And that relates on how you're going to use the internet and then how you're going to relate to that.
I actually feel the same way. So in this case, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and just a quick comment on that is I think for this type of discussion, that's one of the reasons it's so important to have these discussions with people whose experiences are vastly different, because one of the things about metaphors is they become invisible when you are using them. And I think a lot of the framing here is about sort of getting into a situation where you can see them and feel them and think about them. You know, there's an interesting thing on framing itself. And so part of the idea is that when you talk to people who see things differently than you do, it highlights how your perspective is shaping your view, and it's a subjective view of yours, and so it's a useful way of, because left to yourself, one's own subjective view always seems like an objective view of the universe. So, how about
very briefly, I just wait one more day, then I'm done, and you can be done.
All right. Well, you know, this is a sincere effort to answer your question.
Okay. Good. We'll get to you in a second. Okay. Go ahead.
I wonder, the question to me is, what did they call an ecosystem before they came up with the word ecosystem? I mean, in a way, that's what we need to do. So, with the internet, we need to come up with a functional equivalent of the term ecosystem. We didn't have a No, because it's not an ecosystem. An ecosystem is an ecosystem. So, you know, when I think about the framing, I think it is an incredibly complex emergent social system powered by the ability to communicate fast and far and interactively in a dialogue that has, you know, taken the notion of communication to a whole new level, and that we haven't really sorted out what it is. We never will, but I guess that's my beginning attempt at trying to come up with the functional equivalent of the word ecosystem, but for the internet. Because right. The internet isn't an ecosystem, the ecosystem is the ecosystem.
Right. So this is there absolutely what the session was framed as being about.
Yes.
The very last thing I want to say is, I don't think there's, I think we agree about this, I don't think there's a single framing for it. I think frames are ways that we understand things, and we are very fluid in their application. We use inconsistent ones, which is fine, because we're trying to understand different things. There are times when I would be very happy even with a transport. Generally not, but even with a transport. You know, although usually it's misleading, sometimes it gets you to see what you need to see. So multiple overlapping frames, the more the merrier.
I just want to follow by saying,
last comment perhaps?
Yeah, the word internet is as equivalent to more training wheels. That basically the internet is about ability to create solutions despite what's in the way, or opportunity. And that the current internet is just an accidental artifact. And what we're really learning is basically how systems work in new literacy. So like the Industrial Revolution. There's not enough machines, it's about how you make things work. And the current internet, don't confuse even computers with the internet. So once you learn the concept, you know, of math, you don't have to count on your fingers anymore. And the internet is just like counting on our fingers.
Okay, so we've got the internet framed as counting on our fingers. That's a great place to...
And one little meta comment, which is just to think about the word framing, because you can frame a picture, But the other use of word framing as a verb is you frame somebody by accusing them of a crime that they did not commit, that it's a false accusation of their identity and intent. So I'll just leave that as a last little comment for...
And also that frames are bad for social...